Right, we'll start again then. So thank you very much for coming to Suffolk. Nice to see you here. And of course, you are a very familiar face to all of us for so many things. I'm going to rattle through some of the things that you're known for in case you're not familiar with those. Yeah. So a television presenter. There's a huge list of programmes that you've been involved in over the years as well. But I suppose
because it's so many years. I'm so old now, Catherine. If there is a lovely mic techie person there, could you just turn the mics down a tiny bit? Because I think that might be why it's slightly annoying for everyone to listen to. Okay.
So I'm going to list them. Springwatch, Lambing Live, Back to the Land. You're also a campaigner.
I am.
You have recently released a bath and beauty range, is
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah, well, it was because, basically I spend a lot of my time being quite grubby. And I also spend quite a lot of my time in amazing wilderness places. Some of the programmes that I've filmed have been in very remote places. And there's no travel lodge or Premier Inn around the corner, so you have to camp. And quite often wash in rivers. And those rivers, you know, are used by the local communities. People, wash in them, get their drinking water from them. And it's really hard to find good biodegradable stuff that doesn't turn your skin into kind of corrugated cardboard.
Yes.
And I thought, actually, we all should be using biodegradable stuff every day. This is all getting terribly wordy. Sorry. Anyway, so yes, so I went to somebody and said, could we try and make a biodegradable range of bath and beauty stuff that actually smells nice, doesn't make you look 100, and
yes.
Doesn't harm the environment.
Very good.
It's called Humble. No prizes for originality there.
And also using your name, Humble My Nature. So that's your farm in Monmouthshire, which is your home, but it's also a place where people can stay and also where they can learn country crafts or
yeah, so
farming.
It's actually not home. We live just down the road, but it was a farm that was going to be broken up and sold off. It was a council-owned farm, and it just seemed that these small council-owned farms, to me, were still really important. Really important assets for rural communities like ours. And so we took it on, there's a proper farmer living and working there.
Right.
I just get in his way a lot. But alongside his farm and his livestock, we run rural skills courses, which was, I think there was a need for them. Partly because when we moved to our small holding, which is just down the road, we made all the classic mistakes of first-time smallholders. You know, got a gay gander, a really vicious cockerel, completely the wrong sort of piglets, you know, that kind of thing. So we thought it might be useful to be able to run courses so people didn't have to make the same mistakes that we did. But also to demonstrate to the local council that these small farms could be viable if you thought outside the box a bit.
Yeah. And you have written about that experience, haven't you?
I think
that was called Humble by Nature.
It was called Humble by Nature, yes.
So you've written a number of books, which will bring us on to this one shortly. But my question, first of all, is how on earth do you fit it all in? What is your life like? Because you travel a lot, you present a lot, you're writing a lot. And your farm, you know, busy at home as well with the farm. So what is life like for you?
I don't watch a lot of telly. it is a bit of a juggle. I do like being busy. I mean, my husband does a spare that I don't sit down very often. And I'm one of those incredibly smug people that, you know, we're all told to walk 10,000 steps a day. I've done that before breakfast. But I do, you know, I do count myself very lucky that I have found various things that I love to do. And although it sounds like quite a sort of disparate list, there's, you know, they all have things in common. The things I'm writing about are quite often the things that either I just love doing, whether it's walking like this book or you know, the journey that I took to take on the farm and start a rural business. So they're all quite linked. And yes, when you put it like that, it sounds quite busy, but I don't know, everybody manages things. I don't have children. How people have children and a life, I have no idea. That's a really big juggle, I think. I've got 3 dogs and 2 pigs and some chickens, and that seems to be a lot easier, really.
Yes. Yes, but arriving with the dogs tonight in your camper van, I mean, that sounded quite an adventure in itself.
Yes, well, you know, they decided that if we were going to come to beautiful Suffolk, they should definitely come too. So, yes, if anyone goes out into the car park and thinks that there's a pack of wolves lurking, it's my dog, sorry.
So you find walking very therapeutic then. That's the way that you keep on top of things, the busyness in life.
Yeah.
So can you explain a little bit about how that fits into your routine and also how you decided that was so important that you wanted to write about it in this way?
Well, I think, the thing is, as anyone out there who's got a dog or several dogs will know, you know, dogs mean that you have to go out every day. You know, they don't care whether it's raining. Well, actually, my little brown dog doesn't really like going out in the rain, but essentially, they do need to go out. And when we moved, I lived in London for 20 years, which I wasn't very good at because I am a bit of a bumpkin. And this kind of feeling kind of grew and grew over the time that I was there and became overwhelming. And I said, I've got to go back to the countryside because that was where I grew up. And as soon as you move to the country, you know, having a dog basically does seem to be an essential. You know, it's like if you live in, I don't know, some smart part of London, maybe you need a Chanel handbag. If you live in the Welsh countryside, you need a scruffy mongrel. So mongrel, badger, dog number one, came into our lives, and walking then became very much part of the daily routine. You know, first thing in the morning, we'd go out, let the chickens out, feed them, you know, whatever other livestock was around, and then go for a walk. And you know, it was a very unconscious thing, but I started to realise that walking in the morning, first thing, kind of the first thing that I did, was a really lovely way of starting a day. And not just a lovely way of starting a day, it had all sorts of other benefits too. So it allowed me to feel very connected to the landscape and to the seasons, to what was happening. You know, I mean, you know what it's like now? The colours, I don't think the autumn colours, sorry, I'm just going to fiddle with this because it's driving me mad, it's driving me all potty. There we go, is that all right? Yeah. The colours are so beautiful, and you wouldn't, I mean, you can notice them when you're driving down the road in the car, but it's not quite the same thing as kicking through the leaves or of being actually viscerally connected. You know, even on the way here, when we were driving here, we stopped off just to give the dogs a quick scamper. And we were walking through this little bit of woodland, not a particularly spectacular bit of woodland, but there was enough breeze that the leaves were falling, and it was like the most amazing confetti almost. And I just love being able to start a day feeling like I've just had a little bit of connection with the natural world. And actually, when I was writing the book, there is a lot of science. I mean, it's crazy that we have to actually do a scientific study to tell us whether nature is good for us. It is good for us. I think all of us who go out and spend time in nature know that we feel better. But the scientists will back it up and say, actually, genuinely, it is really good for our well-being. And I just found that, you know, that morning walk, I mean, yes, my life is busy and fairly chaotic at times, but what I found was that time, I mean, I run too, but it doesn't have the same effect. There is something, I think, about the pace and rhythm of walking, that it is very rhythmic, and that somehow connects to your brain and allows my head anyway, and lots of people have said the same to me, they said, oh yes, that's how it works for us as well, is that your head sort of clears in a way. You can get, when you get to my age, our age, Catherine confessed we're the same age, although she looks rather better than me, which I'm annoyed about, but anyway, but you don't tend to sleep very well.
very annoying middle age.
And why? It does terrible things to you now. And often in the night, you know, things will get out of perspective, or you kind of worry about things. And I will find that, or you think, gosh, how am I going to fit everything in? You know, I kind of have timetables going off in my head in a kind of mad, deranged way. Poor husband's going, oh my God, when I say, I was thinking about this in the night. He's like, no, don't tell me. I don't want to know what you're thinking in the night. But then you go for a walk, and there is this extraordinary thing of everything feeling much more manageable. And things start to just sort of click into place, or feel less important, or less scary, or less, you know, worrying. And so, as this became part of, you know, part and parcel of my day, I just thought, I'd really like to pull these ideas, these thoughts, these feelings, these impressions of the experiences I have when I walk together. And I didn't really think about it being a book as such. I just thought I might keep a diary. And I'd never kept a diary before, mainly because I'm incredibly boring. And I thought, you know, why? I don't even want to write, went to the supermarket, ate a banana. I don't, you know, it's not interesting enough. But I thought, actually, keeping a diary of walks is different because it's keeping a diary of little natural events. It's when you see the first bluebell come up, or hearing the first skylark, or seeing a peregrine, or something like that. It felt more meaningful to me. But also then, it wrapped up those little events would be wrapped up with how I was feeling or responding to things at the time. And as soon as you start doing that, and you're kind of mindful of it, you start to hear other people's stories, and that's a very key part of this book.
Yes, yeah, so many things to follow up there. It isn't just a diary. I mean, it's great to find out about your walks and your impressions, but you've encompassed so many other things in the book. There are quotes from wise people over the years. There are other stories. How did you collate all those elements? How did you find that you wanted to shape the book?
In the end, it's a funny thing. I mean, writing a book is a really difficult process. I'm not trying to big up how brilliant I am that I managed to do it, but it is. You go through various stages. So I, you know, started off with this idea of thinking it might be nice to keep a diary, and maybe it might end up being a book. And then as I progressed with the diary, I thought, gosh, I would like to try. It was a kind of, without wanting to sound too pompous, it was a kind of, it felt like an intellectual challenge. Could this, you know, turn into a narrative that anyone would want to read? Or indeed a publisher would want to publish? So, you know, you're sort of constantly questioning and trying things out. And then you go, you know, a publisher said, I mean, lots of publishers didn't want to publish it, actually. And then I went to the publisher who did, and she said, I really like this idea. But then you start going through the thing of, actually, is anyone really going to want to read this? Mm-hmm. You know, you go through these endless kind of angst-ridden stages of, oh my goodness, this is so boring. And you think, if it's just a diary, is it really self-indulgent? Should I be talking to other people? Actually, I'd like to talk to other people. So that's when I started researching other people who'd walked for different reasons. And I found this wonderful artist, Paul West, it kind of happened by mistake. I was on a flight to go and do a job, and I was looking at the front cover of the In-Flight magazine, and there was this really beautiful image on the front. It was clearly a reproduction of a painting, and it wasn't figurative, but it was a landscape, and there was something about it that really entranced me. And I turned over the page just to see if there was any information. It said this was a painting done by Paul West, inspired by walking in Wales. And I went, how strange. And at the time, the book wasn't commissioned. It was still this sort of idea of, you know, will it be diary? Will it be interview? How, you know, what will the elements be? And when I found out that this artist, who I'd never heard of, had been inspired by walks in Wales, where I live, I thought, okay, if it gets commissioned, he'll be one of the people that I'll approach and see if he'll be interviewed. And so when it was commissioned, I contacted him through his website and said, you know, I hope you don't think this is weird, but, you know, I'm doing this book and I'd love to talk to you about the inspiration for your art. And went to see him at his studio in London. And one of the stories that he told me, and I won't tell you too much about it, but when you read the book, if you haven't read it, you'll understand why the cover's really important and really intrinsic to actually the stories in the book. And Paul ended up doing the design for the book, which was lovely, so there was a real connection there. And then when you start, as I say, the process of writing a book, you become very tuned in to stories that you hear about people, in my case, obviously, when people walking. And someone happened to mention that I was filming with, oh, you know, there's a girl I know who walked every footpath in Wales. And I went, really? And then I sort of forgot about it. And then I remembered it again when I was thinking about the as I say, the various reasons that people walk. And this astonishing young woman, Ursula, had been diagnosed with cancer, with ovarian cancer. She was only 30. And if anyone can be lucky, she was, because the cancer was contained, so it hadn't spread, even though the tumour was very big. And she had this, you know, quite major surgery, but was told, you know, there is no reason that this cancer is going to reoccur, you know, you've been lucky. But she said, you know, during the period that you're diagnosed and then you're dealing with that diagnosis and then you're dealing with the treatment for that diagnosis, she said your identity just disappears and you become the girl with cancer. And it's really hard. She said cancer took my life away from me. Not literally, but kind of metaphorically, she'd been given this identity that she was the girl with cancer. And when she'd recovered from it, she said, I didn't have an identity anymore. And she did this extraordinary thing. She'd always walked, she loved walking. And she had to go for a 6-month checkup. She was living in Mid Wales. Her checkup was in a hospital in Bristol, and she thought, I'll walk to the checkup. And she walked the length of the River Severn to the hospital, had her checkup, and then she thought, well, I might as well walk home now. And she walked home. And then, for the second checkup, she just didn't stop walking. And she walked 3,500 miles. It's an absolutely extraordinary story. And I contacted her to say, you know, the book's finished and it's published and I'd love to send you a copy. Where shall I send it? And I got an email back saying, I'm in Kiev, about to walk home. I'll be back in about 18 months, but it'd be lovely. I'll look forward to seeing it when I get back. So, those stories. And then the quotes. One of the extraordinary things, I think, about human beings is that we forget stuff. And we have to keep reminding ourselves. And when I started looking at, you know, again, was it just me that felt that walking made us feel good, that had a good effect on us, that had that enabled us to be more creative or to solve problems or to deal with sadnesses? No, of course it's not. You know, I found a quote from a Roman senator in the 1st century AD saying, walking's good for us. You know, how have we forgotten this? Freud used to see his clients walking around the streets of Vienna. And then for some reason, somebody decided that actually the best way to give somebody therapy is to enclose them within four walls in an incredibly confrontational sort of situation. And it's taken, you know, when was Freud practicing? In his sort of early 40s. It's taken all that time for a mad person with the most fabulous name called Clay Cockrell, only in America, for Clay to say, you know, there he is, a therapist in New York, practicing in New York, and he said, you know, it's crazy. When you're in New York, you live in a box, you travel to work in a box, you then work in a box. And he said, no wonder everyone's nuts. No wonder there's so much work for therapists in New York. And he decided that actually it might be more effective to see people outside the box. Literally, think outside the box. And he takes his clients and walks them around Central Park. And I did his client's walk with him in Central Park. And he said, the effects are extraordinary. You know, he'll get somebody, he'll come, you know, sort of screwed up with anxiety and stress and, you know, can't manage their time and never see their families and are worried about money and all that kind of thing. And they're like this. And he says within 15 minutes of walking, their whole body language changes. And the other thing that was really interesting was that, you know, I mean, it's like the first date thing, isn't it? People go to a restaurant on a first date. Madness. You know, you're sitting there, you kind of, you've got to make eye contact, because if you don't, you're weird. And yet, you know, it's really scary making eye contact. It is confrontational. You know, conversation has natural pauses, but somehow if you're in a room, it feels awkward. If you're walking, it doesn't feel awkward that you're not making eye contact. In fact, if you do make eye contact, you're probably going to break your neck because you're going to trip over something. And, you know, pauses just feel natural and you're, you know, you're looking at the environment around you. And so his theory of giving therapy on foot, you know, has a lot of basis. And to say, you know, but he's not a pioneer. Freud was doing it 60, 70, 100 years ago.
Yeah. Masses of information then in just such a small book, it seems. You have packed so much in there. What response have you had from people so far, and what do you hope people will gain from reading the book?
Well, what's been actually slightly bad pun, but what's been quite humbling about the response that I've had to this book is that, of course, walking is very fundamental to us being human. We do it all the time without thinking about it, really. And it is something that, you know, we can all do. Although, before anyone says, hang on a minute, what about somebody in a wheelchair? I've had emails and messages on social media from people in wheelchairs going, it works in wheelchairs too. And I was like, yeah, I know, it's brilliant. And there is a lovely story about a man that I met on a beach in a wheelchair that's, again, very fundamental to one of the joys of walking, of those encounters that you can have. But as I say, you know, walking is a very sort of fundamental thing that we don't really think about. You know, you take your first steps when you're a toddler, and everyone, you know, is, well, nowadays, sending photographs all around the world and, you know, showing their proud grannies and everything. Look, you know, the child's walking. And then no one ever really thinks about it again. It is something that we can all do. It's something that doesn't cost anything. You don't need a load of special kit. I mean, it's quite good if you don't do it in stilettos, but, you know, otherwise. And you know, you can do it anywhere. It can have benefits in cities as well as in the countryside. It's something that we can all do. And what's been lovely, what this book has done, is kind of unlock people's shared experiences. You know, I had a wonderful email, really moving email, after doing a literary festival a couple of weeks ago. And this girl wrote to me and she said, I just wanted to say that I had a baby a couple of years ago, and quite recently, we had a sort of community walk. I live in Sheffield, it's quite hilly. And our community were going for a kind of joint walk up a hill, and she was there with her family. And she said, I went on this walk and I realised that I'd become incredibly unfit because I'd sort of been at home with this baby. And that also, actually, I was really unhappy. I'd become quite isolated and quite lonely in this whole process of becoming a new mum. And she said, I'm really lucky because I've got a lovely husband and a lovely family. I'd read somewhere that walking could be good for you. So I sat down with my husband and I said, I've decided that I'm going to walk a mile every day for the next 100 days. And if that doesn't work, and if it doesn't make me feel better, and if it doesn't make me feel less depressed, because I think that's what I am, I will go to a doctor and I'll get antidepressants. And she said, I didn't ever go to the doctor. Mm. She said, I've walked over 300 miles in the last 100 days, and I absolutely love it, and I do it in all weathers, and it's made me, you know, it's made me so happy. But she said, also, what it's done is it's given me a sense of resilience. She said, if I think, if you're bitten by depression, you never entirely get rid of it. But she said, I now know that I have the resource to be able to deal with it, live with it, and enjoy my life again. It's the most wonderful story, and I'm getting a lot of those.
So how has it affected you in writing the book, that discipline for a start, and getting it published, and then seeing that response, and your own routine in walking each day? How has it affected you?
It's been quite a roller coaster. You know, when I... The first thing was, as you say, the kind of actual physical challenge of writing a book. Not least because I wasn't very disciplined as a diary keeper. And that doesn't mean that I didn't keep the diary entries. I did. I just kept them in a lot of notebooks. And I really like notebooks. I'm sort of mildly obsessed by notebooks. So instead of just, you know, doing January to, say, April in one notebook, I would have bits of January, and then March might be in another notebook. And then, so when I was kind of pulling it all together, I was like, where the bloody hell is April? Which book's it in? But actually, I really enjoyed the process of writing it. I wrote it quite quickly in the end, although the thinking process... So it was an odd one. I mean, it really was a book that, in a funny sort of way, wrote itself, because it took 2 years of... walking and thinking, and then walking and keeping a diary, and then kind of overcoming the hurdle of thinking, could this really be a book? So there was a very long, it had a long gestation period, if you like, and then when I actually sat down to write it, partly because I did the classic writer's thing of putting it off and putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, and I had a deadline, which was Easter this year, and I... Easter was the end of March, I think. By the end of January, it's 80,000 words, which is a fairly usual length for a book. By the end of January, I'd written 8,000 words. So what I had to do, and this is where I have to thank my incredibly patient husband, long-suffering, he was called by somebody the other day, was I had to say, I'm sorry, but I'm leaving you, and take myself off to a little barn in the middle of a field in Herefordshire for 3.5 weeks. And actually, I wrote the majority of it in that time. And if I had my mad middle-aged moment of waking up in the middle of the night, instead of just lying there worrying about things, I'd just get up and write. So I wrote probably 50,000 words in 3.5 weeks.
But did you take the dogs with you then?
Absolutely.
So you were walking?
I was walking then. And it was really important. It was really important. And what I found is I sort of got into a routine. We had a lot of snow, which did help, because it kind of cut down the amount of walking that I could do. But we would start off with a kind of an hour and a half in the morning, and then I'd write for maybe 5 hours, and then do another hour and a half, and then write again. So we did get into a routine, but it's really nice. I mean, apart from anything else, as I said, I'm not very good at sitting down for very long. But actually, the walking felt like... There's a quote in the book that is my favourite quote of all, which was by a woman, a writer called Rebecca Solnit, and she wrote a book called Wanderlust, about walking. And I'm going to sort of paraphrase the quote a bit here, but she said, you know, in a very productive based society where everybody expects you to look and be busy at all times, thinking is doing nothing, or appears to be doing nothing. You can't just sit and think. because that's, yeah, that's idleness. So she said, walking is the closest to doing nothing that allows you to think. And she, when she was writing and when she is writing, does a lot of walking. And so for me, actually, my excuse was the dogs need a walk. But very often, I would find myself in my head, you know, plotting out the next bit of the book or how I was going to interweave an interview that I'd done into the diary entries or whatever. So it was actually, although I wasn't physically sitting at a computer, I was still writing.
Mm. And what about challenges then for you? Because you're walking a lot each day, that's important, but do you set yourself a challenge of I want to do a certain distance? I know you run as well, don't you? So how does that work with the walking routine, if you like?
Walking, I don't... Well, actually, that's not true. There was a challenge that I sort of set myself for the book, in a way. Well, the book was a perfect excuse to do something that I had promised myself that I would do pretty much the minute that I moved to Wales and to the Wye Valley. So the River Wye is 136 miles long, or the River Wye walk is. The River Wye rises in mid Wales in a place called Plynlimmon, and it runs into the Severn estuary and out into the Bristol Channel. And I live pretty much, well, just above the river, on a hill above the river, very close to where it runs into the Severn estuary. And so when we moved there, I heard that there was a Wye Valley walk, you know, a sort of a marked walk. I thought, gosh, that would be a really lovely thing to do one day, you know, just to walk home from the beginning of the Wye. And as I suspect we all do a bit, you know, when there's something right on your doorstep, you think, oh, yeah, I'll do it next month, or I'll do it next year, or I'll do it. And suddenly I realised I'd lived there for 10 years and I still hadn't done it. And I thought, if I'm going to do this book, maybe this is the year. This is the year to really try and nail this thing that has been kind of, you know, fluttering away in the back of my mind for so long. And by chance, I had a job booked in Zambia, a country I absolutely love, in June last year. And it was cancelled, and I was really upset. And it was 9 days I was going to be away. And I thought, it's a sign. I'm not going to say that, you know, I'm now available to do other work. I'm going to go and do the Wye Valley walk in that gap that's now opened up. And we did a day-long walk. So as I say, it's 136 miles, and I had 9 days to do it in. And one of the things that I really wanted to do was I wanted to do it on my own with the only dog of mine. So I've got three dogs. Teg, my sheepdog, is immensely fit and strong and loves walking, can walk all day. If I'd suggested to Badger and Bella that we were going to do 136 miles, they'd have phoned the RSPCA and said, take us back. So I thought I'd love to do it with Teg, and I'd like to do it camping. I'd like to be self-contained, you know, carry everything on my back. I kind of loved the idea of this kind of a real connection with my landscape, with my home, and you know, camping in it and yeah, just sort of and not being removed from it. There was one issue that sort of slightly put pay to that idea. Was when I worked out how much dog food I was going to have to carry. I thought, right, I'm going to have to do... So we did food drops in two B&Bs. I had two nights in B&Bs on the way just to pick up the dog food. But otherwise, we camped. And that was the plan. But I knew that if I was going to be able to do the distance in the time, I was going to have to do some really long days, more than 20 miles a day. And so... We did a sort of test walk at Easter. There's a lovely walk near us called the Three Castles Walk, and it's just over 19 miles. And I thought, well, that'd be a really good test. I won't be carrying all the stuff, but, you know, at least it'll tell me whether I can do the distance or not. And it's quite a hilly walk, the Three Castles Walk. And by the end of the day, when I crawled into the pub, I was like, oh my God, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this, carrying everything. So I was quite nervous about setting off on this walk and thinking, you know, it's that horrible thing of thinking, actually, am I too old to do this? You know, am I too old to do it? And the other slight concern is that my map reading skills aren't that brilliant. And long-suffering husband was pretty sure that I would end up in Snowdonia rather than at home, because I'd just turn left when it should obviously have been right and, you know, head off. And it was, I mean, I'm not very technically minded, and I know you can get apps on your phone, but a lot of that part of Wales, there's no signal, there's no, you know, 3, 4G, there's none of that sort of stuff. And also, there's something about seeing a map on the phone is not the same. You know, I love my paper OS maps, but to do the whole route with the OS maps, I'd need, I think it was 10 maps. And the dog food was obviously more important. So I had photocopied bits of the route, and I had to get something that I'd always been really scathing of, which was a map holder. Oh my God, only really nerdy walkers have a map holder. And red socks and poles. Oh my God, I loved my map holder. I loved it. So I had all my bits of paper in my map holder. And what was so funny was that Teg, the dog, would start to realise when we had perhaps lost the path. We weren't lost. We'd just lost the path. And I'd pick up the map holder and be a bit like that. And she'd be sitting at my feet looking at me. And honestly, if she could have tutted, she would have been like, really? What, again? What, we have to go back? No kidding. You know, it was so funny. She absolutely knew when I was like, we might be a little bit lost again, Teg. You know. So we probably didn't do 136 miles. We probably did quite a lot more. but it was that great feeling. You know, that great feeling of thinking we all have, you know, we're all assaged by doubt and you know, belittle our capabilities, think that we can't do something, think that we're too old or, you know, come up with a million excuses why we don't do things. And actually to do that walk, you know, just to do something that actually I really wanted to do. And sometimes people say, gosh, you know, you kind of think, can I be that self-indulgent? Well, hell yes, you can. And it makes you feel great. And I did feel like I'd overcome, you know, all sorts of, you know, tiny hurdles, fairly insignificant hurdles, but all joined together. I did feel really proud when I finally did make it home and sat on the grass looking out over the valley with all the plasters on my toes from the blisters.
And home is obviously very important to you, and it sounds very beautiful where you live as well. What about all the travelling then? How do you feel when you are given another assignment to go somewhere? I mean, obviously there's the excitement of going somewhere else, but how is that tug with home and leaving everything behind and seeing a different landscape but missing something?
It's funny, my mum always said that even when I was a very, very small, that I had this sort of terrible case of itchy feet, not athlete's foot, you understand, but just, you know, constantly wanting to go and explore things. And I was given, I think for my third birthday, I was given a wheelbarrow. That's what it was like in the 70s. Didn't get PlayStations, you got wheelbarrows. I was given a wheelbarrow and I was found a mile away from home with my wheelbarrow, just going for an adventure, you know. Again, no health and safety, fantastic, you know, no one cared what you did. And that wanderlust is still very much kind of part of me, I think. I do, the world is endlessly fascinating and has this, you know, wonderful capacity still to surprise and delight and shock, and but you know, it we live on a very, very exciting planet. And the odd thing though is since moving to Wales, when we moved lived in London, and I would go away for a job, quite often I would extend my time wherever I was, you know, because I just didn't really want to come back to London. And now, the really odd thing, you know, as far as I'm aware, I don't have a shred of Welsh DNA. You know, I'm your classic kind of blow-in. But it's the only place I've ever felt homesick for. And it is very, very strange. I can't explain it. So I still get really excited about trips. I still absolutely love being away, having some of the most, some of the extraordinary experiences that I've been lucky enough to have. But now I really look forward to coming home. And I just wish that J.K. Rowling could take the idea that she has of Harry Potter being able to travel about the way that he does. Somebody could make that real. It would be fantastic because, you know, you can have an amazing trip and then you've got that awful journey home. And what you really want to do is either get on your magic carpet or get into, you know, go down a chimney or whatever it is that Harry Potter does and just be home like that. Yeah. That would be perfect.
Well, we're very pleased that you've come to Suffolk, and you're spending a little time here as well, aren't you? So what is your connection with the county?
Well, my very lovely parents, who are both from Yorkshire originally, after they married, lived here in Suffolk, very close to here, and were extremely happy, had and still have very, very good friends. I think two of them might be here, in fact. But they loved Suffolk. It was a place that they were extremely, extremely happy. A girl I was at school with hated her. Absolutely hated her. But she lives here, and I thought, well, rather than shell out in a hotel, I'll see if I can... one of my very, very dearest and most wonderful friends. And of course I'm only saying that because she's here in the audience, we've known each other since we were 11, which is quite a long time now, and she and I, we had a bet when we were about 13 or 14. I had a bet with her, and it's quite a weird thing, so I know it sounds weird, but I'm going to tell you anyway. We had a bet. I was so sure that I was never going to have children. I bet her £10, which was a fortune when we were 14, that I would never have kids. And I remember her coming to the house that we were living in London, and we bought it as a complete wreck and kind of rebuilt it. And she walked in, she said, I've never been into a house that is so unchild friendly, and handed me a tenner. And I think it was the following year that she had her first child, and she phoned up and she said, in revenge for losing the bet, I'm going to make you godmother. And so the gorgeous Tilly is my godchild, and she lives here. So her mum's dreadful, but she was worth coming for.
Well, very glad that you're here, and I'm sure everybody here is. So have we got any questions from the audience? We haven't got a roving mic tonight. You're going to shout, if that's okay, and we shall repeat the question, just so that everybody's clear what has been asked. But who'd like to go first? We can see. Don't be shy.
No one. They're all thinking, yes. Actually, what we really want is a gin and tonic.
Yes, over in the back there, yes.
Have you got a favourite walk? What walk you've done, a favourite UK walk? That's a really tricky one. A lot of it, I think, depends on weather, on season, on what mood you're in. You know, at this time of year, it is lovely to go for a walk in the woods, you know, whichever woods those are, because they are so beautiful. And I'm very lucky in the Wye Valley, we have, you know, beautiful woodland around us. In fact, it's so stunning at the moment that people just literally stop their cars in the middle of the road to get out and take photographs. So woodland walks at this time of year I love, but I also do really love going to the coast at this time of year. And last weekend we went down to a place just outside Bridgend in South Wales. There's an area called Ogmore, and there's this amazing set of dunes, and they've got woods on them. So you get, you know, these kind of rolling dunes and the woods, and then, you know, going to the sea, particularly when it's kind of blustery and wild, and There's lots of interesting things to see, kind of post-storms that have been thrown up on beaches. So I do love a beach walk at this time of year. But then there's something really energising about climbing a hill, which is quite difficult when you're in Suffolk. I know there are some. I'm just being a little bit cheeky, but I do love that thing that sometimes when you're feeling like you've been sitting down for a long time, or you know, if you've been doing a lot of travelling, often if I've come back, I've had a long flight and then, you know, had to get home, there's something lovely about just sort of getting your heart rate up and getting up a hill. And, you know, even if the weather isn't great, there is always the reward when you get to the top of a different perspective on your world and that feeling of achievement. So, yeah, it's more, there aren't sort of particular places that I could cite as favourites, but, yeah, of sort of landscapes, I suppose. Does that help?
Thank you.
Yes, in the front.
Do you walk on your own in the morning? Does your husband go with you?
Do I walk on my own in the morning, or does my husband go with me? Most of the time, I walk on my own. I think he's delighted that I'm happy to take the dogs off and he can have a nice cup of coffee. But I really like walking by myself. Again, I think when it's headspace time. And actually, you know, if you think about it, we have so little time in the lives we all lead now, and with phones that ping at you all the time, and there is something really wonderful about walking alone. And I think, and it's something that I explore in the book, is if you choose to walk alone, you're not lonely. You know, it's kind of glorious solitude. It's very different from loneliness. But there are lovely things, of course, about walking with my husband, or walking with friends, or, you know, sometimes it's just, I say, a lovely way of catching up with people. So both things have their merits. But as I say, for me, it is I like that solitary time first thing in the morning, just to sort myself out. And for my husband, I think it's ideal, because it means that I don't then just download a load of rubbish onto him. You know, the minute I wake up, I've been thinking about this and this, like, just go for a walk and sort it out and then come back and be normal.
How often do you go for a run, and when do you decide to walk or run?
Slightly depends what I've eaten the night before and how guilty I'm feeling. I probably run 5 times a week, but you know, my sheepdog Teg, she needs a lot of exercise, and so I run with her a lot. But then I'll walk in a day as well, often. So it'll often be both things. But sometimes I wake up in the morning and my knees hurt and I think, I can't run. Or I'm just sort of feel a bit knackered. And then I walk, and actually, you know, that's the other kind of slightly miraculous thing about walking, is that you can wake up feeling really sort of sluggish and exhausted. You know, I've been doing quite a big book tour in the last month, and travelling around a lot and driving a lot, or being in cars a lot, and very often, you know, you kind of wake up feeling just a bit exhausted but I have to walk because the dogs need walking, and it is amazingly restorative. So there will be mornings I'll wake up and I think, I just haven't got the energy to run now, and I haven't really got the energy to walk, but I've got to. You do that walk, mm-hmm. and you come back feeling, oh, actually, I'm really glad I did that.
Mm. Gosh, very impressive, though. anybody else?
When I went on my camping walk, did I wild camp or pre-book site? The beginning of the walk, so the bit in Mid Wales, actually there really aren't any campsites. I wild camped. I probably wild camped, I'm trying to think how many nights I did. Was it 8 nights? And 2 of them were in B&Bs, and I probably wild camped for 4 nights, and then there were campsites for 2 other nights. But what I did with the wild camping was, you know, even though, like, the first night, I was crossing quite a wild bit of kind of moorland, and I probably could have just put the tent up somewhere, but you always feel conscious that it's probably somebody's land, or, you know, someone's going to come along. So I actually walked down to a lane and saw a woman with her horse, and I said, "Do you happen to own these fields down here?" And she said, "No, I don't. I rent them off a farmer down the lane." And I said, "Well, I'm just looking for somewhere to camp tonight. Would it be okay?" And she said, "Well, I'll phone the farmer." And she phoned the farmer, and he said, "You can camp there if you like. It's very midgy." And it was. But it feels you feel a lot more comfortable asking permission if you can. But it is wonderful while camping, because you do feel like, you know, you're kind of really out in the wilderness. You do get a bit smelly, but it was only me and the dog, and the dog didn't seem to care. Yes. Do I ever feel concerned about my safety when I'm wild camping or running or walking? The short answer is no. And it may be because I've just been very lucky and I've never had any reason to feel unsafe. I'm quite optimistic about the human race. There was one moment when I was doing the Wye Valley Walk, actually, that we were in quite a kind of lonely place, and I hadn't really seen very many people. In fact, I don't think I'd seen anybody all day. And we were walking, Teg and I were walking down this sort of long, it was almost like a ride, and I could see something in the distance ahead of me, and I couldn't work out what it was. I thought it was a sheep, but we weren't in a sheep field, and I was trying to look, was it a big ram, what was it? And as we got closer, I realised it was a very, very big dog. And it was on a lead, and it was attached to a man with a hoodie up. And the dog looked quite threatening, and the man looked quite threatening. And he had a big rucksack propped up against a gate. And my first thought was, gosh, I feel a little bit vulnerable at this point. And then I thought, God, don't be so bloody stupid. You know, why should you feel vulnerable? It's just a guy and a dog. And I called ahead and I said, because his dog was on a lead, and I said, would you like me to put my dog on a lead? And he said, yes, please, because my dog might attack it. So I said, okay. So I put Teg on a lead and I walked up and I thought, I could just walk past, but, you know, when you live in the countryside, we don't just walk past people. You say hello. You know, even if it's just a hello, you do. It's just country law, isn't it? And I stopped and said something like, what a beautiful dog. It was an amazing dog. And I said, are you doing the Wye Valley Walk by any chance? And he said, kind of. And it turned out he was on the run. And it was a really extraordinary story, and I write about it and I think about him a lot. But he his dog was half wolf, half dog. Ridiculous. He said, it's ridiculous. I know I shouldn't have a dog like this. And he lived in a council flat somewhere in Dartmouth, and he had been planning to walk from Land's End to John O'Groats. And he was in the pub with his dog to say goodbye to his mates, and something happened. He said, I don't know what happened, but his dog attacked one of his friends, someone he knew well, and attacked him so badly that he had to go to hospital for quite a long time. And the landlord called the police, and he thought, if the police come, they're going to shoot this dog. So he started walking, and he'd been walking for 3 months when I met him. And he said, one day probably we'll get caught, but I'm just going to keep walking with my dog until we do. So, yeah, it's an extraordinary story. But as I say, no, I don't ever feel worried for my safety, and maybe that's stupid, or maybe that's actually the most sensible thing to feel.
A couple more.
Is there a walk that you would like?
Oh, there's millions. And when, you know, when I was sort of putting the ideas and or sort of pulling together ideas for the book, I was thinking about things like pilgrimages. There's amazing walks in Japan. I used to work for a Japanese television company in the very early 90s, but never went to Japan, which was really frustrating. I have been to Tokyo Airport, and that is it. And it sounds like the most wonderful country to walk in, and there are these incredible kind of Buddhist kind of mindfulness walks that I would love to do. There's some incredible walking. There's a pilgrimage walk in Norway that sounds amazing. So there's lots of those, you know, lots of kind of far flung walks that I would love to do. But also, you know, we are very lucky in this country. We're astonishingly lucky in this country. First of all, because we have Ordnance Survey. And when you travel to other countries, you realise that having access to maps that detailed, that are that accessible, and frankly that cheap, is a real luxury. Very, very few countries have that resource. And also, you know, our right to roam, our network of footpaths, and the amazing long distance footpaths that we have. My next walk that I would really like to do close to home is the Brecon Way, the Brecon Beacons Way, which is 100 miles across the Brecon Beacons, although my husband thinks it'll probably be 300 miles by the time I've navigated my way from one side to the other. But that's the next one on my hit list.
Is there here?
So being asked why I haven't got any photographs in the book when walking is so visual. I took some photographs when I was walking, but more as part of the diary, really. And also because I don't really like to take a phone with me when I'm walking. The hard thing about a photograph, sometimes I think, certainly my skill as a photographer is limited, to say the least. And I often find that a photograph of a landscape doesn't encapsulate what you're feeling. And, you know, this book is as much about what you feel when you're walking as about what you're seeing. And I hope that I've been able to articulate the beauty of a landscape without needing to photograph it. And I think sometimes one of the beauties of writing or indeed listening to radio is that you can create, it's your pictures in your head rather than mine and imposing an image that I've seen. I would rather your imagination go for the walk with me and paint those pictures rather than it being more prescriptive. So yes, it was a very conscious decision not to have photographs in the book.
And the leaf story is very important.
The leaf story is very important. So the leaf actually became the motif through the book. So yes, it's not without illustration, but I didn't want it. I think if it was photographs, it would end up being more like a kind of walking guidebook, which it absolutely isn't.
One more?
Yes.
You went skinny dipping. Was that liberating?
I went skinny dipping. Was it liberating? I do skinny dipping a lot. I just happened to do it once on the telly. And it is fantastically liberating. I love it. I love, you know, it's funny. When you say to people that you quite like taking your clothes off, when you're outside, everyone then says you're a naturist. I go, no, I'm a naturalist. It's very different. And also, it doesn't mean that I want to. I get a lot of invitations from naturist clubs, you know, come and join us. Like, no, I really don't want to look at anyone else's bits. I'm very happy just, you know, it's just a private thing. And getting into water without any clothes on is a wonderful sensory experience. And as I say, I do it a lot. We were in France this summer. We have a tiny little shack in a very rural part of France, and it sits on its. It has its own lake. In fact, we bought a lake, and it just happened to have a shack on it. And it's completely off grid, and tucked away in the woods, and I swim in that lake every day with nothing on, and it's lovely. But then we, when we were coming home, we stopped off in Brittany, and I found another lake, which was a rather lovely running route. So I would go very, but of course it's completely public. So I'd go very, very early in the morning and do my run and then make sure there's no one around and quickly leap in. I think there was one morning that a fisherman perhaps got more than he bargained for. But it is very liberating. And the other thing, particularly the incident that you're referring to, which was the lake in Wales in April, which is, you know, astonishingly cold time of year to get into fresh or seawater. We think the lake water was about 2 degrees. It had snowed the day before. I was in full thermals before I stripped off. I have never experienced anything like it. I mean, it is extraordinary. You can't breathe, you can't do anything. But, you know, if, and I'm not saying that you would do this, but if you stand in front of a mirror at this age and think, oh, you know what? Gravity really isn't very kind to us, is it? And you get into that cold water, you never need to think about surgery again. You are so hurt. Well, for a kind of a week anyway. Then everything starts to sag again. But for the immediate after effect, it's like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Well, what a way to finish.
Well, you know, I like to hand on the pearls of my wisdom.
So what happens next then after this? I mean, you said that you're on quite a book tour at the moment.
Yeah.
So what are the projects lined up for next year, for example, and will you be writing something else?
I'd like to say that I'm doing another television series. Teg, the Welsh sheepdog, is doing another television series. I've been kind of reduced to entourage. So we filmed part of it, and we're going to be filming again in the spring. Yes, doing a few more book dates and things. I'm doing an amazing journey next year, which I'm very excited about, which I actually did this year. I worked with a company that take groups to wild places to see wildlife, and they asked if I would host a group going to Svalbard in the Arctic, and I took a group for 12 days, and we had the most extraordinary wildlife viewing, absolutely extraordinary. I put it down to one of the guests, who was a wonderful woman called Linda, who's an American, and she was in her 70s. She was completely fantastic. And everyone else had come in their kind of rowan and their proper, you know, outdoor gear and everything. We were on a boat, a small boat, but going ashore a lot. And obviously one of the key species that people want to see when they go to Svalbard is a polar bear. And on the first morning, everyone's dressed up in their kind of sensible outfits with their woolly hats and everything. And she came down in a dress covered in polar bears. And she had a polar bear hat, she had polar bear tights, she had polar bear gloves, and she said, "Sweetie, I'm your totem." We saw 34 polar bears. It was entirely down to Linda. And it was amazing, amazing, amazing trip. And the company has asked me to go back again next year. But there is quite a lot of sexism in the Arctic and in Arctic travel. And a lot of the expedition leaders, in fact, all the expedition leaders on trips like this and that trip that I did, the expedition leader was a man. There is no reason. There are some very capable women working in the Arctic, and there is absolutely no reason that they shouldn't be expedition leaders, but for some reason, they are never hired. So we are doing an all-woman expedition-led trip to Svalbard next year.
Wow.
Well,
yeah.
Done.
Yes.
We'll probably get lost.
Brilliant. Well, it's been fantastic
thank
this
you.
Evening, so
it's
thank
been
you
lovely.
So much.
Such a lovely audience.